ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। देवास्यार्हात्सु साय वाय सत्सु तत्र ब्रह्मा तत्र प्रमात्मजादीषु राजन्याद् अग्रपूजायां मता फत्राथयुच्छत् मता फत्राथयुच्छत्युता। O King Yudhisthira, the demigods, many sages and saints, including even the four sons of Lord Brahma and I myself, were present at your Rajasuya sacrificial ceremony. But when there was a question of who should be the first person worshipped, everyone decided upon Lord Krishna, the Supreme Person. Purport. This is a reference to the Rajasuya sacrifice performed by Maharaj Yudhisthira. In that meeting, there was a great turmoil over selecting the best person to be worshipped first. Everyone decided to worship Sri Krishna. The only protest came from Shishupal, and because of his vehement opposition, he was killed by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The king of the earth in the time of the Vedic culture was to be the protector, the father of all Praja, or all those who are dependent upon him. It is not that the king would discriminate. In today's times, the politicians very much discriminate and favor those who will help them to raise funds or to give them votes. But therefore, no one trusts politicians today. All over the world, it is well proven that politicians are easily paid off, depending on the country, either above the table or under the table. And through this payment, they become wealthy and they have financial support to defeat their opponents in the following elections. Therefore, there is always this canvassing. In a democracy, there is always this process of trying to canvass money and canvass votes. It is called a political campaign. And generally, the person who has the most money will reach out to the most people and get the most votes and will come out victorious in the election. Generally, one of the first analysis of the media is how much money each particular nominee or party has to spend on their campaign propaganda. Because to the degree you have money and you advertise, to that degree, generally, you get votes. Of course, money and political advertisement generally has nothing to do with getting across the message that you are trying to relate to the people. Simply people see your names in big letters and they remember you and give some importance to you. And because people are basically sudras, very, very ignorant in their ability to discriminate, they will simply vote for the person that they heard about the most. It's not a question of the issues. just like in the West, they have debates. And it's not a question of who speaks the best in the debate. It's a question of who looks the most like a dramatic actor. Because people do not even understand what they're talking about. Even very intelligent people can hardly understand what they're talking about in debates. And worse than that, they're constantly slinging mud at one another and challenging one another that why you did this and no, I didn't do that, but you did this. No, I didn't do that, but you did this and this is why. And really nobody knows who's speaking the truth and who's speaking lies. The average person who's sitting in front of their television or sitting before the debate, they're denying things they were supposed to have done. They're claiming things that they haven't done. Who knows whether it's true or not? Nobody knows. 99% of the audience, the particular topics that they speak about have nothing to do with reality because they do not know whether that what they're saying is true or false. So it's not a question of what they say or what they believe, it's a question of how they present themselves. The last president of the United States, everyone knows that it wasn't that he had such good things to say, it wasn't that he was such a philanthropic person, it was because he was an ex-movie actor, he was a very famous movie actor, and he knew how to just speak and portray himself in such a way that he looked like a very congenial, trustworthy father, and he knew how to be very much trusted, not by the integrity of his life, but by being a good actor. In fact, I remember when he was nominated, when he was elected president, several other of his colleagues in the film industry, they were making comments. They said he was a terrible actor and therefore he's going to be a worse president because the only qualification he has is his acting. And practically every one of his colleagues were completely disappointed that he won the election because they knew that he was just a good actor. He could just go right into people's hearts with whatever he said. They didn't know what he said. Nobody cared what he said, but the way he said it was just very nice. It's like you go to the movies, a good actor can make you cry, he can make you laugh, he can make you feel happy, he can make you feel sad, he can make you feel protected, he could put you in fear. Of course, acting is the profession of a sudra, according to the Vedic standards. Somebody who's simply paid to behave in certain ways. So, of course, in previous times, the person who was the king was the most heroic, brave, and courageous protector of mankind. Kshatriya literally means one who protects another from pain. So it was the Kshatriyas that were the kings. And therefore, generally, the people who became kings were people who were great warriors. Even in modern times, just like in my country in America, originally the people that became the presidents were generals in the army. The first president was George Washington. He was a great warrior. He was leading armies fearlessly to protect the American cause, willing to risk his life. So they were singing, "This is the man we want to lead us." Most of the presidents were like that, big generals, very, very courageous persons who proved on the battlefield that they were fearless and ready to risk their lives. Of course, later on, all sorts of stories of immorality came out about all these people. But that wasn't so important because, after all, they were men who were first in the battle and willing to lay their life down. We find in the Battle of Kurukshetra, it is not that Maharaj Yudhisthira or Maharaj Duryodhana, although they were basically the persons who were meant to be kings, it's not that they were sitting in a bomb shelter somewhere 5,000 or 10,000 miles away from the battlefield giving directions on a telephone. They were the first ones lined up on the front lines of the battlefield with their bows and arrows, ready to be the first ones to give their lives for their cause. That is a kshatriya. But then later on, I know in the country where I am from, what happened is the kshatriyas were no longer suited to be kings. Therefore, the vaishyas, people who were just big businessmen, who just made a lot of money in business and manipulation and exploitation. Then later on, because they had so much money and so much influence, they convinced the people to vote for them, and the Vaishyas started becoming kings. And then the Sudras, movie actors, they started becoming kings because they could act better than the others. They could put on a better show, performance. So the integrity of the nation is based on the integrity of the leadership of the nation. And today, in practically every democracy in the world, the more you have money, the more you become a powerful candidate. And the only way to get money is ultimately to do things illegal, to accept bribes, to have people in your cabinet accept bribes. And we see that there are, in practically every country in the world, there are these scandals of people exploiting and doing illegal things to get money. Therefore, under this condition, with this mentality, how can a person really be a compassionate father for all of his praja, for all of his dependents in the nation? But in the Vedic civilization, there was a monarchy when there was no question of votes. It was a question of qualification. The great Brahmins, the great sages, and the great Kshatriyas with a real high sense of honor, they would select a king amongst those people who were born and raised in a family where they were trained to be perfect first-class kings. And the first and foremost qualification was how much they were surrendered to religious principles. And here we find the instance of Maharaj Yudhisthira. He was a true king. He was a king in the highest sense because he put himself last and he put his citizens always first. He was Mahajano Yena Gata Sapanta. He was following in the footsteps of the previous great kings. You can only become great by following in the footsteps of someone who is great. If you do not follow in the footsteps of a great person, you will never really be great. No one should think that on my own, by my own standard, by my own power, by my own glory, I will become great. You become great by becoming the servant of the example of the great souls. So who were the great souls in the Vedic history that Maharaj Yudhisthira was following? There were such great personalities as Maharaj Sibi. Maharaj Sibi showed how a king puts himself last and even the least of the creatures in his kingdom first. Maharaj Sibi, it is described that one time a pigeon, what living entity is more insignificant and less look up to in the kingdom than a pigeon? In every city, there's millions and millions of pigeons, and they're just flying around getting in everyone's way. And the most respect they get is one out of millions of people goes to the park and throws little pieces of bread to them, and they all gather around. And everyone else just looks around and say, why are you throwing bread? You're just bringing all these pigeons to the ground and they get in our way. You just let them fly away. If a pigeon dies, who cares? If a pigeon lives, who cares? But a pigeon came into the home of Maharaj Sibi in great anxiety. He said, there is a hawk who is about to kill me and eat me, and you are the king, and it is your duty to give every one of your citizens protection, and any person who is living in your land is your citizen. Therefore, I deserve protection as much as anyone else. And Maharaj Sibi said, yes, that is a fact. It is my duty to protect you as it is the duty of a king to protect even a pigeon to the same extent he's willing to protect his own son. The king does not discriminate what is mine. He considers it in the service of God that he is the father and protector of everyone. So the hawk came in. Maharaj Sibi said, you will have to first kill me if you want to eat this pigeon, because I am giving my life to protect it. And the hawk said, oh yes, well what about me? I am also your citizen, as much as this pigeon. And my food is eating pigeon, and if you do not give me this pigeon, I will starve. So why? What are you going to supply to me? My food is meat. Human beings may not, the king does not allow them to eat meat, but in meat-eating animals, it is their right to eat meat. It is their God-given nature. So Maharaj Sibi said, all right. He said, in order to protect this pigeon, if you want meat, the weight of this pigeon, I will cut flesh off of my own body and you can eat. So the hawk said, all right, I agree to this proposal. Now you weigh the pigeon, you put him on scale, and then you put your flesh. So they put the pigeon on one end of the scale, and then Maharaj Sibi, with his sword, he cut off his own flesh from his own body. Very painful, blood coming out, and he put it on the scale, and the pigeon outweighed his flesh. And then he cut off more and put it on the scale, but the pigeon still weighed more. And then he cut off more and more and more. Finally, he realized that this pigeon weighed so much, even though he was such a small size, that Maharaj Sibi just jumped up onto the scale. And he sat on the scale, and when he sat, the balance of the weight was exactly equal. So he told the hawk, you eat me, you kill me. I will be your food. Because it is the duty of the king that he must be willing to give his life to protect even the most insignificant amongst the creatures depending on him. And the honor of a king was very high. That to live without his honor, to live without understanding that he was following the principles of the previous great souls, is worse than death. There's no meaning to your life. People now, they're willing to do anything to prolong their life. People like Kamsa, he was willing to engage in the most heinous, sinful atrocities just to spare his life. When the voice came in the sky and said, Kamsa, the eighth child of your sister is going to kill you, Kamsa was immediately about to kill an innocent woman just to protect his own life. And after Vasudev, through so much argument and logic, convinced him that there's no danger from Devaki, it's the children, spare her life. After that, every one of these innocent little babies who were born in his kingdom as his praja, six in a row, he dashed them against a rock with all of his great strength, which is equal to 10,000 elephants, and massacred them. And when the eighth child, Lord Sri Krishna, when he found out that he escaped the hands of death, he sent message that all children born anywhere within the vicinity of that time would be ruthlessly massacred. Why was he doing like this? Because his life was so dear to him that he was willing to engage in the most horrible acts of terrorism, just to protect his flesh and blood, which was destined to die in due course of time anyway. But Maharaj Sibi was just the opposite. He was voluntarily willing to give his body up immediately just to protect a bird. Because he knew that to live without the sense of honor and integrity before God and his citizens would be more painful than death. At that time, the pigeon and the hawk both transformed in their bodies into effulgent demigods. And they said that we have just tested you just to show the world the glory of your sacrifice to your citizens, just to show what a great servant of God you are. There are many stories in this regard, showing the great sacrifice of kings. It is described in the Bhagavatam also, Maharaj Ugrasena, that one time a Brahmin came to him and said, "My son died as a small child before me. It is the duty of a king to make sure everything takes place according to its natural order. If a king is properly leading the citizens and properly performing sacrifice, then everything will take place in its natural form in this world. Now, the natural sequence of events is that the father should die before the son, but my son died before me, and I am feeling great loneliness and separation, and I have to blame you." And Ugrasena had to take the complete blame. He said, "There's something wrong with the way I'm running my kingdom. Otherwise, this could not have happened." And then Arjuna, being the servant of the great king, he made a vow. He said, "I vow that I will enter into fire. I will kill myself unless I can go to the abode of Yama and find your son and bring him back." Because he saw the lamentation of the king. So Arjuna, he was traveling all over the universe looking for the spirit soul of this child, along with Lord Krishna, to bring it back. This is how much, to the extent that the king considered himself the most humble servant of his citizens. There's no question of exploitation amongst such saints. Therefore, they are called Rajarishis or Rajarshi, which means they are not only kings, but they are saints, they are sadhus, they are rishis. If you are not a great rishi, you are not entitled to be a king. And the Brahmins of the time, they would protect the citizens by making sure the king was living according to the highest order of religious principles. And if he was not, it was the Brahmin's duty to instruct the king or to remove the king. There is an example of this in the fourth canto of Bhagavatam. There was a king of the name Anga. Maharaj Anga was a very great, powerful king. And he was a very great devotee of the Lord. And he had a son whose name was Maharaj Vena. Now this Vena Maharaj was very special in the sense that it is said that in family life, generally, the daughter takes on the qualities of the father's mother. And generally, the son takes on the qualities of the mother's father. So Maharaj Anga married a woman, and her father was death personified. So naturally, his son took on the qualities of death personified. And he was the most cruel-hearted, wicked-minded, envious and selfish person from his very birth. And Maharaj Ranga was such a pious and religious man. He was doing everything within his power to train his son to be a noble king and great soul. Maharaj Vena was very powerful. By his birth, he was very powerful. But he used all of his power for wicked things. When he was a little boy, he used to play games with his friends. And in the games, he would take advantage of his high and powerful position, and he would torture his friends and kill them. And he was always doing the most ferocious atrocities. And Maharaj Ranga was just constantly getting news of the horrible terrorism that his son was doing. And he didn't know how to control him. So finally, after so many years, Maharaj Ranga gave up. He realized there's nothing I could do for this boy. Factually, a parent can do everything he can to try to train the child to be Krishna conscious, but ultimately the child has his free choice. Ultimately, the parent has to be detached. So Maharaj Ranga accepted, after years and years of suffering, the misery of seeing what his child was doing, he felt that this is Krishna's mercy. Krishna wants me to become detached from family life. If I had a very nice son, I would be so attached to my family. But since I have a useless, horrible son, my family is completely a miserable condition. I don't want any part of it. So therefore, Maharaj Ranga very secretly just left one day and went into the forest to take up the staff of renunciation and dedicate his life exclusively to the worship of the lotus feet of Lord Hari. So there had to be a king, and the only one who had the position and power was Venu. So Venu was made the king. And as soon as he became king, he sat on the throne and he said, "Brahmins, from now on, there is no sacrifice for Vishnu, there's only sacrifice for me. I am your God. There is no chanting of the names of Lord Hari. From now on, you chant the name of Lord Vena. I am immediately the God in your life. The king is the representative of God, therefore I am God." He made all religious sacrifice, all religious rituals, illegal. And he himself personally, as well as his soldiers, were very, very strictly protecting this law and enforcing it. In this way, he was very, very powerful. The rogues and thieves were scared of him like anything. But the religious and pious people were very, very brokenhearted, because they were given no facility to utilize their human life for what it is for, to worship God. So therefore the Brahmins finally came together after years of seeing all the religious principles being destroyed by this egocentric maniac of a king, Vena. And they decided that we have the power to remove him. So they chanted mantras, Hamkara. And through the chanting of special mantras and performing of secret sacrifices, the king died at the hands of the Brahmins. And of course, the king's mother, who was attached to him, because a mother's love for a child is usually very blind, she preserved his body. And then after the king died, the rogues and thieves, they just began to plunder the entire kingdom. Because although Vena was a very wicked, godless man, he was very powerful, and the rogues and thieves were afraid of him. But when there is not a strong leader, then the criminal-minded people, they just come out and completely take over the society. It is said that the whole kingdom was just covered with dust. Why? Because the rogues and thieves were just running in all directions, just causing a whole cloud of dust as they were just stealing and exploiting everyone. So the Brahmins came together. We have to have a powerful king. Without a king, without a leader, there's no peace in society. So they decided that Maharaj Vena, he was a descendant of Dhruva Maharaj. He was the son of Maharaj Ranga. So the king should be a descendant of him to keep the bloodline of Dhruva still in continuation. So what they did is they churned his body. And the first thing they had to do is churn out all of his sinfulness. And through the process of churning, from his legs came a very, very dark form of a dwarfed man named Bahuka, who had reddish hair like copper, black skin, red eyes. And he was the personification of all Vena's sins. And he took a lowly position and said, "How may I serve you, Brahmins?" They said, "Go to the forest where no one will be disturbed by you." And then after all the sinfulness of Vena was taken out, they churned his body again. And like the sun rising from the horizon and the sea, the most beautiful effulgent pair of personalities appeared. It was Maharaj Prithu and his wife Archie, who were none other than the most exalted incarnations of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And when Maharaj Prithu was coronated as the king, even the devatas, the demigods, came down to have darshan of him, knowing that he was the Supreme God incarnate. And he ruled the citizens, and he ruled the world fearlessly according to the highest religious principles. He knew that the first and foremost duty of a king is to be a religious man and to perform sacrifice for the religious prosperity of the whole kingdom. Therefore, time and time again, he would perform the Ashwamedha Jagga. Now, it is said in this universe that the only person who had performed the Ashwamedha Jagga 100 times was Indra. Now, Maharaj Prithu, not for his own glorification, but for the purification of the kingdom, to facilitate every citizen to go back to Godhead, he was performing these sacrifices. Because the performance of these sacrifices would invoke the blessings of the Supreme God as well as all the demigods and create a purifying effect through the entire atmosphere. And in this way, facilitate every member of the kingdom to make spiritual advancement. That is why the kings would perform these sacrifices. Not for any selfish reasons. To perform these sacrifices was a huge, huge endeavor. And the king would have to go through great, great trials, tribulations, and austerities to perform this sacrifice simply for the sake of the upliftment of his kingdom. So Maharaj Prithu performed this sacrifice 99 times, which is unimaginable. Generally, if a king could perform this sacrifice once in his life, he goes down in history forever as a great king who gave so much to his citizens. At that time, Indra became very much worried that I have the record of 100, and if Prithu Maharaj ties my record and does more sacrifices than me, then my fame will be diminished. So at that time, Maharaj Indra stole the sacrificial horse by so many crooked means, And again and again and again, he was stealing the sacrificial horse. In fact, when Maharaj Prithu went to chase after him, Indra disguised himself as a sannyasi, one in the renounced order, just to engage in illicit activities of stealing what belonged to the king. And of course, Indra was apprehended, and Maharaj Prithu, he realized that this disguise that he was using as a sannyasi to protect himself was bogus, and Indra deserved to be punished. It is said that this was the beginning of the corruption of the renounced order of life, when fools, rascals, and rogues disguise themselves as sannyasis just to take advantage of the respectability and honor that a sannyasi deserves without having any of the qualifications. This was the beginning. And since Maharaj Indra, so many thousands and thousands and thousands of people have followed in his footsteps without qualifications, taking the robes of a sadhu for their own selfish purposes. So at that time, it is described, it is a long story, we will summarize, but at that time, Vishnu himself came down, along with Brahma and others, and they convinced Maharaj Prithu that you should not upset Indra unnecessarily. You have performed enough sacrifices. Just let Indra have the most. There's no need to perform anymore. And Prithu Maharaj said, yes, yes, whatever pleases you, my lord. I am not attached to fame or name or prestige. I am simply doing it for your pleasure. If it is your pleasure, I do not perform it, then I will not. This is the true meaning of surrender. That you are simply attached to pleasing your master. Sometimes we become so attached to our service and doing it well that we're not really doing it at the beginning. We were doing it for our master, but after we became expert and begin to get good name and fame for what we were doing as being great devotees, then we become very much motivated to maintain the prestigious position I am in and excel all others. And we're not so much thinking in terms of what pleases the master, but we're thinking of what pleases ourselves in the service of our master. Therefore, we become attached to our service. Not for the pleasure of the master, but for the pleasure of our own profit, adoration, and distinction. Therefore, detachment means if the master tells you, do not do your service, you immediately say, forget it. I have no need to do like this. For so many years, I've been preparing myself to do this service. If you do not want it, I do not want it either. Yesterday, we were describing Ekalavya. Ekalavya, his whole life, he was dedicated to pleasing Drona by becoming the greatest archer. Day and night, he was practicing for his whole life. And then Drona said, cut off your thumb. Cutting off the thumb means you can never shoot another arrow for the rest of your life. And Ekalavya, he was honestly trying to be the greatest archer to please his guru. Not simply because he liked to be an archer, or he wanted to become famous. So without even hesitating, he took his sharpened arrow and cut off his thumb, and without the slightest bit of anger or animosity toward his guru, he placed that thumb at the feet of his guru and said, here is your dakshin, Guru Maharaj. I will never shoot another arrow again, if it is your desire. That is detachment. And there are many instances of such detachments amongst the great souls. Sometimes the spiritual master tells you, I want you to do like this. He gives you an instruction, and then you prepare yourself for years and years and years developing and perfecting that particular service, and then the guru says, I don't want you to do that anymore. And that's a question of how much, then you are tested, how much you are doing it for yourself and how much you are doing it for him. If you're actually doing it for him, you're willing to give it up in a second. Okay, I'll do something I don't know. And he'll give you something to do that you know nothing about, that you do the worst, where there'll be no profit, no adoration, no distinction. People will laugh at you. And you're willing to accept it, if that's what pleases you. And the king is supposed to be the example. The great souls are the example for all people to follow. So just see the glory of Maharaj Prithu. He could have become famous throughout history at performing more Aswamedha Jagas than Indra. He had it all prepared. It was about to take place, this sacrifice. But as soon as Vishnu said, listen, let Indra, he's attached to his pride and prestige, let him have it, forget this jagya. Prithu Maharaj said, well, it's already forgotten. I was only doing it for your pleasure. I do not care about setting any records or going down in history. I'm only concerned with being your menial servant. So this is the glory of the great kings. How much they lived only as a sacrifice to God and to each and every one of their citizens in the service of God. So Maharaj Yudhisthira, here it is described, he is about to perform the Rajasuya sacrifice. The Rajasuya sacrifice is a very difficult sacrifice to perform. Before a king can perform the Rajasuya sacrifice, he has to conquer the entire planet Earth. And after he conquers the entire planet Earth, he has to send his messengers to every kingdom, to every corner, to every village, to every town within the planet. And he has to get the persons who are ruling that areas to voluntarily agree to be a surrendered servant of the emperor. And if anyone is not willing by word and by practice to be the humble servant and assistant of the emperor, then that person must be challenged to a war and defeated. And in this way, it's usually a long process. You have to have every man, woman, and every citizen on the earth subordinate to you voluntarily. When that takes place, then you can perform the Rajasuya sacrifice. In this regard, Nakula, Sahadeva, Arjuna, and Bhima, they traveled to the four directions all over the planet. And they found that every king on earth accepted the supreme authority of Yudhisthira Maharaj except one. Do you remember who that is? It was Jarasandha. He refused to accept the supremacy of Yudhisthira Maharaj. So therefore, Krishna, Arjuna, and Bhima were dispatched by Yudhisthira Maharaj to deal with this Jarasandha. He had to be defeated if he wasn't willing to accept. So Maharaj Bhima, Arjuna, and Lord Sri Krishna, they disguised themselves as Brahmins because they knew that Jarasandha, one of the ways he had attained and preserved great power is he would give in charity to anyone who would come to him. Even the demons would be very charitable because they knew they would lose all their power and opulence if they were not charitable. So they disguised themselves as Brahmins to beg. And when Jarasandha saw them, he saw that what kind of Brahmins are these with such big shoulders and wide arms and so strong looking, and not only that, they have impressions of bows and arrows on their shoulder. So he could understand that these people were actually great warriors. But because they came to him in the role of Brahmins, he understood, I have to treat them like Brahmins. What would you like? I will give you any charity, whatever you desire. And then they said, ah, you will? Okay. I am Bhima, I am Arjuna, this is Krishna. We want to fight with you. Because you do not accept Yudhisthira as the king. He said, I will not fight with Krishna because Krishna ran from the battlefield last time I fought with him. His name is Ranchur, which means he's a coward. I will, it's below my integrity to fight with a coward. And Arjuna, you're younger than me and you're not as powerful as me. You are not worthy to fight with me. But Bhima is a suitable match. I will fight with you. Choose your weapons. So they decided to fight. And Jarasandha was very powerful. And Bhima was very powerful. And they would fight from sunrise to sunset. And neither one could defeat the other. And this fight was going on day after day after day after day. And they were just utilizing every ounce, every gram of their strength to try to defeat the other. And they were growling at one another and pounding at one another and ripping at one another. but neither one could defeat the other. They were Maharatis. So the Pandavas were becoming very frustrated. What are we going to do with this Jarasandha? He cannot be defeated. Of course, Krishna knows everything. He knew the secret behind Jarasandha's birth. When Jarasandha was born, he came out. He was in two halves. And so they threw him in the forest, and a witch, a very black magic practicing witch of the name Jara, threw her magical powers, she put him together. And the name Jarasandha means one who was put together by the witch Jara. So therefore there was a seam going across the middle of his body from his head to his lowest parts. And that was his vulnerability. So Krishna, he explained to Bhima that you have to rip him in half. That's the only way. You have to know where exactly the seam is. So when they were fighting, they were growling at each other and pounding at one another, and Bhima just could not defeat this man. And Krishna was looking, and he took a piece of grass. And he said, Bhima, just watch this. I'll show you how he can be killed. And he took the grass, and he just pulled and tore it in half. And then Bhima realized, this is the way he could be killed. So Bhima took Jarasandha and put... Hari Hari. He took Jarasandha and put his feet on one of his legs and took his mighty arms on the other leg and pulled it up and just ripped those two legs apart. And as he ripped, Jarasandha was ripped into two. And as he laid there on one side, there was one eye, half of a nose, half of a mouth, one breast, one half of his genitals, one leg, and on the other side was the other half. And everyone was cheering, Jai Bhima. And after this took place, they returned to Maharaj Yudhisthira and said, now, Maharaj Yudhisthira, there is no one on earth that does not accept your supreme authority. Now you can perform the Rajasuya sacrifice. And then, of course, from that point, he had to raise what is equivalent to billions and billions and billions of rupees to properly perform the sacrifice. It is explained that the Pandavas, they had to accumulate huge amounts of gold in order to perform this sacrifice. It's a great challenge. And when everything was in order, and they had the highest Brahmins ready to perform the sacrifice, before the sacrifice can begin, there is a ceremony called Agni Puja. Agni Puja means you have to take the greatest man on all of the earth and the king has to personally worship that personality. And this is always a great controversy. Who's the greatest man on earth? Who will the king choose? So of course Maharaj Yudhisthira, without hesitation, he chose Lord Sri Krishna. He knew that Krishna was the Supreme Personality of Godhead, the cause of all causes, who had incarnated only to show mercy and kindness upon all living beings. So therefore, when he chose Lord Sri Krishna to be the recipient of the Agni Puja, the Agra Puja, it's Agra Puja. At that time, everyone was celebrating Maharaj Yudhisthira's great intelligence and devotion. All the Kshatriyas present were saying, yes, 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 there is no doubt Krishna is the greatest of the great. Parameshwar. He is the supreme controller of all controllers. And there was great joy and celebration when the news came out that Krishna would be the recipient of the Agra Puja. Except there was one envious person who did not like it, and that was Shishupal. And when Shishupal saw that Krishna was about to be worshipped by Maharaj Yudhisthira, he was infuriated, and he just stood up in the assembly with his eyes red like hot coals in anger, and his tongue was just wagging like with uncontrollable envy. And he began to say, what kind of nonsense assembly of Kshatriyas is this that you're choosing such a low-class person as Krishna to be the recipient of such a celebrated form of worship? Why you are putting him on the special throne and altar? Nobody even knows what caste he is. He's supposed to be Vasudevan Devaki's son, but then he lived in Vrindavan like a cowherd boy. A keeper of cows, as the son of Nanda and Yashoda. And not only that, he stole Rukmini like a thief, like a jackal steals a sheep. And he just went on and on and on and began to explain how Krishna was such a crooked fellow. And he actually believed these things. That's the amazing thing. Huh? You see, Krishna reciprocates with you according to how you approach him. If you approach Krishna to find faults, Krishna will reveal to you unlimited faults. Sometimes people approach a sadhu and they think they find so many faults, and somebody says, how possibly can anyone find fault in a sadhu, in a pure devotee of the Lord? Of course you could find faults in a pure, if you want to live. What you seek, you shall find. If you look for faults, you will find faults. If you look for virtues, you will find virtues. Up to Krishna. Shishupal was looking for faults, therefore Krishna revealed to him nothing but faults. If you want to find fault in Krishna, Krishna will reveal to you infinite amount of faults for you to justify why should I surrender to him. What to speak of surrendering to the temple president or the resident sannyasi or the spiritual master. If you want to find faults, Krishna will give you the faith and the understanding and the intelligence to see so many faults. Krishna reveals himself personally as well as through his representatives according to how you approach him. Maharaj Yudhisthira was approaching Krishna only to see his glory. Therefore, Krishna revealed his infinite glory. Shishupal was approaching Krishna only to see faults to justify his own independent behavior. Therefore, Krishna revealed to him. Krishna did not show Shishupal one single virtue. He revealed to Shishupal nothing but faults. Although he was faultless from within the heart, he was giving Shishupal the intelligence to only see faults, because that's what he wanted. So Shishupal just was insulting Krishna in so many horrible words, and Bhima was ready to just tear this rascal to pieces, and Krishna was saying, no, just let him be. Practically everyone in the assembly, they were just trembling with rage. They were just saying, Krishna, let me kill this rascal, this demon. How can we tolerate hearing these insults? And Krishna said, no. Because Krishna gave him a benediction when he was a little child that up to 100 insults, he would be protected. But after that 100... So Shishupal was always very careful to come to the point of 99 and then stop. But this time he was so infuriated with rage to see Krishna in such an elevated position of worship. He didn't even bother to count, and he was blaspheming. And Krishna was just very patiently, in a very detached manner, just sitting there listening. And when he saw that Shishupal went beyond his quota, he took his Sudarshan chakra and his head fell to the ground. And everyone in the assembly was very happy. that, ah, the demon has died. And then Maharaj Yudhisthira set by his very, very excellent and perfect example the proper process for all people to follow. That however great you are the humble servant of Krishna. The greatest man is the person who accepts the humblest position as a servant of Krishna. And Maharaj Yudhisthira showed that his becoming a king, his conquering all the lands, his performing of all these great sacrifices, his giving his life, was all simply in his menial devotion to Lord Sri Krishna. Atha pumbir dvijasreshtas varna shrama vibhaga shashvanushtatasya dharmasya samsadir haritoshanam. Whatever your varna or ashram may be, whether you are Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya, or Sudra, a Brahmachari, Grihastha, Vanaprastha, or Sannyas, one should know that the only purpose and only goal of one's life is to please Krishna. And Maharaj Yudhisthira showed in the most super excellent manner how the leader of society considers himself nothing but the menial, humble servant of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.